Bibles to Acts chapter 21. Our study tonight is the remainder of the 21st chapter, where Tim left off this past Sunday, into chapter 22 through the 21st verse. So Acts 21:17 through Acts 22:21. And what we'll do tonight a lot of is right now we're sort of pausing looking at the epistles because, frankly, we've gone through all the journey letters. Those are all complete. We will spend some time at the latter part of this quarter looking at some post-Acts letters that Paul wrote, as well as what the Waldrons call in their curriculum the general epistles, some not written by Paul. But for our study going through Acts, We are through with the journey letters, and we'll pretty much stay in the Acts record until we complete it, and then we'll pick up some other letters. So we're in Acts right now. This is the section of Luke's record where Paul is journeying to Jerusalem, and let's show the sort of some bullet points, the trip so far that Paul has made since the end of the third journey that will get him to Jerusalem. All right, we'll show a map again just in a moment. But just a quick review. He went, when he was at Corinth, where he wrote, what was the last letter we looked at? He wrote from Corinth. Starts with an R. Romans. So when he left Corinth, he was going back to Judea. And where he went up back through Macedonia by land, across the upper part of the Aegean Sea, and he's going to go over back to the western coast of Asia Minor. So back by land through Macedonia, he sailed to Troas. The familiar verse in Acts 20 and verse 7, that's where they met to break bread, and he met with the saints there to do that. Then he comes to Miletus, and he calls for who? The elders from the church at Ephesus, and he gave that speech that we read in Acts chapter 20. Then he left Miletus, and Luke writes that they sailed around the southern tip of the west coast of Asia Minor, past a few islands there, and they found a vessel headed for Phoenicia, which is north of Jerusalem, Judea. They landed at Tyre, which is in Phoenicia, old Phoenician city. And eventually they made their way to Caesarea. And whose house did they go to? Tim mentioned this Sunday. One of the seven. Philip, the evangelist. And he stayed there. And while in Caesarea, a prophet comes. His name was Agabus. And that, by the way, that was the second time that Paul had had an encounter with Agabus. This wasn't the first one. There was a previous time, if you recall, in Acts 11, where Agabus came and said, there's going to be a famine in Judea. Same prophet. So all that took place when Paul finally landed back in Caesarea, Syria, the Judean area, long way away from his journeys where he had been over in Asia and Macedonia and Achaia. So now let's not forget also, what's Paul carrying with him? All right, he's got the funds or the money that had been collected on the third journey for the needy saints in Judea. I've often wondered how much money it was. I'm sure it was quite a bit. But that was for the needy saints. So he's got that with him on his journey. So here's the map, and we'll look at this real quickly. So here he was over here in Corinth, where he wrote Romans. Went back up through Macedonia, around the Aegean Sea area. Came, sailed from Philippi, landed at Troas, broke bread with the saints there, preached until midnight, came down, he was going to bypass Ephesus, which he did, came to Miletus, met the Ephesian elders, had the meeting with them, came around this southern tip of western Asia Minor, then came all the way down here to, to Tyre, landed at Tyre in Phoenicia, then made his way down to Caesarea. And that's getting him just really close to landing at Jerusalem. That's where we're headed with these records in Acts now. So, He arrives at Jerusalem. We pick now in Acts 21 and verse 17, you'll see, when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. As Tim pointed out Sunday, again, notice the pronouns. They've changed from they and he and so forth to we. So that's another reminder that what's going on with the travel party. Who's with him? Luke is with him. And Luke will stay with him through the rest of the Acts record. In fact, Luke goes to prison with Paul, it appears, as we see from not only this, but in the prison epistles also. Now, what I'm going to do is, as we go through this section of Acts, I want us to go back and pick up some reminders or some other information from earlier in the Acts record and compare to what we read here in our study tonight to kind of give us a fuller picture. All right? Notice, first of all, that Luke writes, again in Acts 21, verse 17, when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. Obviously, we know this is not Paul's first time in Jerusalem. He'd been there before on more than one occasion. I've got on the chart Acts 9 and verse 26. Do you recall when Paul was converted, when he was baptized, where did he try to go? To Jerusalem. And as Luke writes earlier in the Acts record, he tried to join himself with the disciples. What was the reception then? It wasn't gladly. Do you recall? They did not believe him. They wanted nothing to do with him. They thought it was a hoax. This is a trick. Get him, get inside the number here and he'll take us all to jail. Kill us, have us beaten, whatever. So they didn't believe him. Yes, well, that's correct. That is correct. That was his intention earlier, was to go and persecute the Christians. But on the road to Damascus, he had the vision from the Lord, and so forth. So that's a story we've covered. But Barnabas came to his defense, spoke up for him, and the brethren received him. But now we have in our study tonight, the brethren did receive him gladly. All right. Also listed on the chart is Acts 11 and verse 30. This was another time Paul had been to Jerusalem. He and Barnabas went to take relief to the saints after the first prophecy by Agabus that there was going to be a famine. So he went to Jerusalem there. Acts 15 and verse 4, he went to Jerusalem. What was in Acts 15, do you recall? Yes, when we call it that council, that conference over circumcision. And Barnabas and Paul went up there and had the dispute with the Jewish Christians who were teaching otherwise. And then to me, which is a very subtle point, look in Acts 18 and verse 22. When the second journey was complete, right before the third journey started, and it doesn't say Jerusalem here, but I think it's implied. Look at verse 22. When he had landed at Caesarea, that ended the second journey, Luke writes, he went up and greeted the church and came down to Antioch. Well, where's the up to? That's Jerusalem. I believe that's Jerusalem. So here's all the other times Paul's been to Jerusalem. But now he's coming, and he knows there's going to be some trouble. We've already looked at indicators in the previous class that Tim led us in. Agabus told him, the one who owns this belt, he's going to be bound at Jerusalem. He's going to suffer. So that's where Paul is coming now. But when he gets there, the brethren receive him and his traveling party gladly, Luke writes. Look at verse 19. Paul begins to give a report. He recounts how the Lord has blessed him in his journeys, his work. After he had greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. Paul's got a lot to talk about. Paul's got a lot to relate to these brethren about all the good things God has done through him in his preaching, planting churches, the letters that he had written, all these things we've been through in the last chapter or two. And so Paul gives a report, we might say. On the heels of that, James and the elders. James was a prominent man. We think this to be James, the Lord's brother. We know it's not James the apostle because from Acts 12, he's had his head cut off. He's dead. But this is either James the other apostle. We think it's James the Lord's brother. Whichever James it was is really beside the point. The prominent James at Jerusalem and the elders tell Paul, there's probably going to be some trouble with the Jews. Is that anything new for Paul to deal with? He's had that on numerous occasions. So they sort of give Paul a heads up here. Here's what we suggest that you do, that you head off this Jewish objection. We pick this up in verse 20. They're saying to Paul, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. And they have been told about you that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the custom." Now we'll stop right there. Would Paul have taught that? To forsake Moses? Well, if you want to be pleasing to God now in the new covenant, wouldn't you forsake the law of Moses, in a manner of speaking? Could you be pleasing to God and be his child in the New Testament days and keep to Moses' covenant? Obviously not. Now, sometimes it depends on how you spin something, whether it's true or whether it's false. Has Paul totally forsaken Moses and not kept any traditions or customs? The answer is no. We'll see that just in a moment. So they say that you're telling people to forsake Moses, not circumcise their children. Did he have Timothy circumcised earlier in Acts? Yes. In that conference, they took Titus. Did they have him circumcised? No. Remember, they did not yield to the Jews. So again, it depends on the reason why these things were coming up as to whether Paul would walk according to a Mosaic custom, or whether it was done for spiritual reasons, for eternity's sake. I'm not trying to make it difficult, but I think we could look at this verse. It could be interpreted in one of two ways, depending on the context in which they meant it. But be that as it may. So they're telling Paul, that's what you're up against. So here we have this suggestion. What was their suggestion to Paul? Who do they bring up? We got these four guys, right? We got these four men. And they're under a vow. Waldron's in their book, pretty strong indication that they say this is clearly the Nazarite vow. I'm not sure if it is or not, but we'll go with that one way or the other. It doesn't make any difference for the sake of the story. They were under a vow for purification. What did James and the elders tell Paul to do? Two things. Number one, join them in the vow, right? Take up the vow with them and do something else. Pay their expenses. Whatever the costs were in making sacrifices when the vow was completed, you join them and you pony up and you pay it. Now, what would that have done? Well, first off, did Paul do that? Yes, he did. Now, what was that hopefully to prove? Is Paul going back to the law? Is he forsaking the gospel of Christ? Well, no. Yes, absolutely. And I've got listed on the chart here. You know, what would this prove to the Jews? Well, again, Acts 16, verse 3, he had Timothy circumcised on the second journey. Why? Because Timothy was going to join him in going to preach to the Jews. Timothy's mother was a Jewess, his father was a Greek. So Paul said, Timothy, we need to have you circumcised so that the Jews will listen to your preaching. 1 Corinthians 9, he wrote, I become all things to all men that I might save or win some. So again, it would depend on which custom Paul would adhere to, and not only that, but why he would do it. So in this case, when he's undertaking this vow, if it was a Nazarite vow, whatever other vow it could have been, to me is irrelevant. Paul is trying to show these people, especially these Jews, look, I'm a Jew. I've been circumcised. I've kept the law. But I do adhere to some customs, some form of the customs, but I'm not doing it for my soul's sake. I'm a Christian now. I'm an apostle. So you can do some things as long as it's done for the right reason. So if you want to call this an appeasement, if you want to call it an olive branch to the Jews, whatever you want to call it, it's clear that Paul is doing this, and he agreed to do this so that they might head off this clash with this potential clash with the Jews. So Paul does go through with the vow. Yes, Freddie. Yes, Peter made a big mistake. Absolutely. And that's covered in Galatians chapter 2. And Paul withstood Peter to his face because he did it for the wrong reason. That's a good parallel. Now, so that was for the Jews. Look at verse 25. But concerning the Gentiles who have believed. So we got the Jews covered. Then James and the elders say, now about these Gentiles, what do they bring up? What do they reference? That letter that came out of the 15th chapter of Acts, that conference. Remember, they wrote the letter. In fact, James suggested in Acts 15 that they write, that was his suggestion that they write the letter. Now he says, now that will cover these Jews and their problem, but concerning the Gentiles, remember, we wrote that letter. Paul and Barnabas, they helped circulate that letter among the Gentile churches, primarily in the Galatian region. We covered that earlier. So we're trying to cover everybody's bases here. The Jews' objection to Paul, they're going to try to run head on into him and have it out. But we're also going to try to cover the Gentiles, so they don't have to worry about this either. So that was the suggestion when he arrives at Jerusalem from James and the apostles. Now, starting in verse 27 of Acts 21, Paul is seized in the temple. Luke writes, when the 7 days were over, that is the 7 days of the vow. So the vow has run its course. 7 days are over. The Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the multitude and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." So, did James's idea for Paul to take this vow, what did it work? Well, apparently not. Because they still stirred up trouble, caused a big commotion. So a mob results. And the Jews accused Paul of teaching against the law everywhere, that is to say, not just in Jerusalem or Judea, but in fact, where are they from? Were they Jews from Jerusalem? They're from Asia. So perhaps they've heard themselves, they heard some of Paul's preaching. Let me stop here and sometimes, you know, we'll make an observation about someone who has a particular religious persuasion. Sometimes others, they may show us up with their conviction. I'm not saying I agree with what they teach. If they're teaching something that's not in the scripture, we can't go along with that. But you just gotta give people credit for their conviction about something. How far did these Jews come from? They're from Asia. Where Paul had been, they've come all this way. I don't say they're hunting him down, but they came a long way to try to discredit Paul and to undercut his ministry and to undo his teaching, undo his influence. So they say he's taught against Moses everywhere, and besides, he's brought Greeks into the temple. Now, what was their proof he had done that? Look at the next verse. What's Luke write? This is verse 29. They had seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with Paul, and then they supposed, or they assumed, what had happened. Well, he's in the temple with Paul. Well, they didn't see Trophimus in the temple, did they? But they just assumed that he was, because they saw him in the city. So, what happens when you make assumptions? Well, sometimes you're okay with it, but sometimes you're not okay with it. A lot of bad things can happen. So they assumed, wrongly here, that Paul had violated the temple, the holy area, as the Jews saw it. So here we go. Here's the mob now. And let me back up here. Paul has to be rescued by a Roman commander. If you have a marginal note in your Bible, this is not a centurion. He's a commander. What's he got charge of? No, that's a centurion. He's got charge of 1,000 troops. So he's one step above the centurion. He's a big shot. And by the way, what was the Roman army's duty in Jerusalem? Like, why were they put there? Keep peace. Keep ordering things. Well, okay. What we got on our hands right now? What started? It's a mob. It's going to be civil unrest. So look how Luke describes these things. Back in verse 30, all the city was aroused. The people rushed together, taking hold of Paul. They dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. While they're seeking to kill him, report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort, of the battalion, that all Jerusalem was in confusion. And at once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. So they're already starting to beat him. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he began asking who he was and what he had done. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing, some shouting another. And when he could not find out the facts on account of the uproar, he ordered Paul to be brought into the barracks. When he got to the stairs, it so happened that he couldn't even walk up the steps. They had to pick Paul up and carry him up the stairs. So I want you to see, this was mass chaos. Now not only, as we looked at earlier, did the Jews assume wrong about Paul. Look at the commander. He had to carry Paul up the steps, as you see there in verse 35. But the multitude of the people, they were following behind, crying out, "Away with him." And when we got to the barracks, verse 37, how calm is Paul? Put yourself, how calm would you be? I don't know what I'd be. I'd be probably a nervous wreck. But what's Paul say? What's his first thing he says? May I ask you a question? May I say something to you? Verse 37. Commander says, "Do you know Greek? Do you know Greek?" Verse 38. Who else made an assumption? The commander did. Look at verse 38. He says, "Wait a minute. Aren't you that Egyptian who some time ago stirred up the revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" So the Jews made an assumption, and the commander made an assumption. Everybody's assuming things here. And Paul's the only calm one in the bunch. Was Paul an Egyptian? No, he wasn't an Egyptian. What did Paul want to do? What was his request? Okay, now let's stop right there. You just came out of this mob. You've been beaten. The whole city's just covering you up. You got to be carried out of there by the Roman soldiers. You finally get to some sort of a place of safety away from the crowd, and what's Paul want to do? Come back and talk to him. Would you want to do that? I wouldn't think I'd want to do that. But that gives us another insight into the heart of Paul. Can I go talk to these people? May I address the assembly? May I address this mob of people out there? That was his request. "I am a Jew," verse 39, "of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." The commander gave Paul permission. Paul stood on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand, and there was a great hush. He spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, now we get into chapter 22. Here's Paul's speech. He speaks in the Hebrew dialect. Look at verse 2 of chapter 22. What kind of effect did that have? Immediate. They got quiet. Almost instantaneously, it looks like. "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense which I now offer to you." When they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. So Paul's got a platform now. That's exactly what he wanted. So here's his speech. He reminds him of his pedigree, verse 3. What's he say about himself? I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, Jerusalem, educated at the feet of or under Gamaliel. Where have we heard Gamaliel's name before? It's on the chart. Acts chapter 5. What part did Gamaliel play on that episode? You remember when all the apostles, not just Peter and James, Peter and John from chapter 3, when they healed the lame man, but all the apostles were brought before the Sanhedrin, and they were going to beat them and stone them. A member of the council named Gamaliel stood up. Remember what he said, basically? You better leave these men alone. Because if this thing that they're doing, if it's of men, what'll happen to it? Because he gave two examples that had previously taken place. It was of men, came to nothing. But if this is of God, you can't fight against this. This was a wise man. Paul was his student. Gamaliel had been his teacher, his mentor. So he said, look, I brought up in this city. I was educated at the feet of Gamaliel. Strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. We have something in common, people. What did he say? I know exactly who you are. I know what you're thinking. I know why you're doing what you're doing. I can relate to you. That's what he's saying. So he reminds him of his pedigree. He reminds him then of his prior behavior. Verses 4 and 5. What had he done? I've done what you're doing now, and even to a worser extent. I was consenting to Stephen's death. I've got listed on the chart there verses from chapters 8 and 9 of Acts. Luke writes, he breathed threats against the church. He made havoc of the church. Luke even writes that Paul would go to Christians' homes and drag them out and commit them to prison if they had forsaken Moses and had obeyed the gospel. So Paul knows. He's walked this walk before. He reminds them of that. Then he tells what I'm going to call the Damascus story. Luke doesn't. That's my phrase. Now, we've covered this in Acts chapter 9. So why don't you now is hold your place here and flip back to Acts 9. And list comparison things between Acts 9 and Acts 22 that I think will be good food for thought. He reminds him of the Damascus. He's going to retell of his conversion. All right, let's notice some differences, and I'm not saying the differences that makes the text wrong. I'm just saying sometimes, you know, you have to look at multiple accounts of one event to get the whole story. And this would be good practice if we ever talk with someone who says, look, here's a contradiction. No, you just have to compare the whole record, and you'll get the complete picture. Compare first off the description of the Lord's voice. In Acts 9, remember, Paul hears the voice. Verse 4, you'll see, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Who art thou, Lord? I am Jesus whom you persecute. In verse 5, but arise, enter the city, it shall be told you what you must do. Now, look at verse 7. The men who traveled with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. Look at Acts 22, verse 9. And those who were with me beheld the light, to be sure. Now some versions say, did not hear the voice. Did your version say that? Did not hear the voice. But really that means they did not understand or comprehend the voice. So there's the contradiction goes away. They heard something, but they didn't understand it. They didn't comprehend it. Paul did. So we see that comparison in Paul's, in the original version when it happened, and Paul telling it here. I want you to compare the description of Ananias. And I must be honest, this, I did not notice this until studying for the lesson tonight. I never picked up on this. Back to Acts 9. What role did Ananias play in Paul's conversion? I'm having trouble with this mic tonight, and I apologize for that. It won't stay on my ear. In Acts 9, what role did Ananias play? Okay, where was Ananias? Was he on the road with Paul? No. He was in Damascus. And the voice of the Lord told Paul, you arise, or Saul at the time, rather, I'm sorry, Saul, you arise and go to the gate called, Beautiful. And you ask for the gate called Straight, I'm sorry, and ask, well, I agree with you. That's my fault too. I didn't look at the, that's right, I'm a false teacher now. The gate called Straight, ask for the man named Ananias, he's going to help you. So that's when Ananias, that's the role he played. Now, how was he described in Acts 9? How does Luke describe him? Verse 10. Well, he did. He argued with the Lord somewhat. But just look at verse 10 in Acts 9 by itself. How did Luke describe him? He's a disciple. That's all we know, isn't it? He's a disciple. Look at Acts 22. How's Paul describe him now? Verse 12. A certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there. Does that mean Ananias was a Jew? Sounds like it. If that's true, what I'm saying is this. If that's so, if that's true, what had he left to become a Christian? How devout was he to the gospel? He had left the law himself. Now, if the wording of Acts 22 indicates he was a Jew himself, could he have been devout by the law but still be a Gentile? I guess it's possible. But just the way Luke writes this in Acts 22, seems to me he was more than just a disciple. He had been a Jew first and had obeyed the gospel. So Paul describes him that way. Paul's status as a witness, an apostle, is verified. Look in Acts 22. Ananias tells him, verse 14, the God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one. So we ask the question, did Paul ever see Jesus? He did, based on this. Now, of course, Jesus ascended, left the earth before Paul ever obeyed the gospel. But what was the qualification of being an apostle based on Acts chapter 1? When they had to replace Judas, remember what the apostles went through? You had to be a witness. You had to have seen the Lord. Okay, Paul's situation. He's an apostle. He's a witness. Did he see the Lord? Did you ever talk to him? Yes, on the road to Damascus. Absolutely. So he qualified as an apostle. Well, that's brought out in this episode. Let's look at verse 16, a very familiar verse. Acts 22, verse 16. It says, the words of Ananias. This is an important verse on baptism. When we lived in Knoxville years ago, my next door neighbor was a Baptist preacher. I'm not picking on the Baptist. I was raised a Baptist. Be that as it may. He and I had many conversations. One of which, at one time, was Acts 22. And Acts 9, the episode on the road to Damascus. And he said, now, Jeff, you cannot disagree with the fact that Paul was saved on the road to Damascus. I said, well, I can disagree with that. He wasn't saved on the road to Damascus. Well, somebody who went through what Paul went through, and this is a phrase of a lot of denominational people, that was his salvation experience, or his experience of grace. He talked to the Lord got a hold of him and saved him right then and there. I said, well, let's go to Acts 22. What's in Acts 22? Well, let's just turn there. Go to Acts 22. I said, Paul is telling the story of what happened in Acts chapter 9. I said, I'm not disagreeing that Paul was saved. Obviously he was. He became a Christian. But it didn't happen on the road to Damascus. And I can show you the reason why I believe that. We went to verse 16. What did Ananias, according to Paul telling the story, this isn't found in Acts 9. This is Paul telling it in Acts 22. What did Ananias tell him? All right. Now, why tarriest thou? Let's stop right there. Why do you wait? What's that tell us about the urgency of salvation? It's an immediate matter. Don't play around with this. Heaven and hell always hang in the balance for one soul. All of us. We're all just a heartbeat away from eternity. Every one of us is. So, Ananias says, why do you tarry? Why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized. Now look at the phrase. And do what? Wash away thy sins, calling upon the name of the Lord. So what did Paul have to do, according to Ananias, based on this verse? He had sins that needed to be washed away, correct? That's what he says. Now, ask the obvious question. If Paul was saved on the road to Damascus, what sins needed to be washed away? None. Paul was told, arise, go to the city, and it will be told you what you must do. See, if you want to be saved by the New Testament gospel of Jesus Christ, there's something you have to do. All of us have to do something. Now that's a vague phrase. We have to believe and repent. We have to do these things. One of which is you must be immersed into water. And not just that, a lot of denominations were baptized. I was baptized when I was, how old was I? 14 years old. I was immersed. I wasn't sprinkled. I was buried in water. But it was not for the purpose of washing away my sins. I was told I was saved first, then I was washed. And that doesn't match up to the New Testament. Paul said, Paul was told, you have sins need to be washed away. So we have a very, very important verse in Paul retelling this account that shows us the importance of, and frankly, the necessity for baptism. It's for the purpose of washing away sins. Yes, when Peter said. Yes. Repent and be baptized for the remission of sins. Right. Could have said a lot of things. Absolutely. Absolutely. You are correct. So, if you ever want a good linchpin verse, if you're talking with somebody, studying yourself, perhaps you need to be baptized for the remission of sins, if that's your situation. I'll tell you, you got to give some serious thought to Acts 22:16. It's just an important verse. It really is. And Paul tells that story. Yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely, Mike. Good point. Calling on the Lord's name means calling upon His authority, and His authority directs us in what to do to be saved, and it does include baptism for remission of sins. So it's just a very, very important verse. Then, so he tells this story. And then finally, our last point is, he informs them of Jesus' instructions to him following his baptism and initial work in the city. Back in Acts 22, notice then, when I returned to Jerusalem, that is from Damascus, he went into Arabia based on Galatians 2, back to Damascus, and he came to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple. I fell into a trance, and I saw him saying to me, make haste, get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me. That's what Jesus told him. What was Paul's initial response? Well, now, wait a minute, Lord. he tries to debate the Lord on this. Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believed in thee. And when the blood of thy servant or witness Stephen was being shed, I also stand by approving, watching out for the cloaks of those. So Paul's saying, look, they'll listen to me. I was one of them. Jesus, strong reply in verse 21. First word was what? Go. And mine says go with an exclamation point. Paul, I'm go. I am sending you far away to who? Gentiles. Now, Tim will pick up, Lord willing, Sunday morning. Look at the first phrase of verse 22. When Paul said the magic word, Gentiles, what happened? There it goes again. There goes the mob situation again. So that's Paul's address in Jerusalem. That's how he got there, the events he went through, okay? When he got to the city, what he was encouraged to do to sort of head off this Jewish mob. But how do you reason with mob mentality anyway? Whether it's this mob or any kind of mob, you can't reason with that. It's mass confusion. But I want us to see the heart of Paul, as we mentioned it as we close. When he was carried out of all that mess, he wanted to go back and talk to them. And look what he told them. He loved these people. He loved their souls. He told of his own conversion. And he gives us, living 2,000 years later, some very, very important information about our own salvation and how we should feel about those who are lost in sin as well. All right. Lord willing, we'll pick up Sunday morning. It'll be lesson 11 on your syllabus. Tim will lead us Acts 22:22 through 23:35. It's pages 185 through 190 in the Waldron's classbook. Appreciate your attention tonight.